The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is John Ivey for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Sports Illustrated for Kids. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the March-April issue of Sports Illustrated for Kids. And we're going to go to our Who's Who section, page 8, and we're going to go to our third line. Michael Penix Jr., Washington Huskies quarterback. His height is 6'3". His weight is 213 pounds. He was born May 8, 2000. Hometown, Tampa, Florida. Penix threw for a school record 4,903 yards as the Huskies advanced to the CFP title game where they lost to Michigan. He won the Maxwell Trophy as the top player in college football, and he finished second in the Heisman Trophy voting. Penix began his career at Indiana, where he played for four seasons. Did you know the NCAA record for most passing yards in a season is held by Bailey Zapp, who threw for 5,967 yards for Western Kentucky in 2021? Nicholas Pampanacallo, Cal Bears center. His height is 6'3". His weight is 242 pounds. He was born August 31st, 2000, hometown, Athens, Greece. Following a season in which he led Cal to its third straight national championship, Pampanacallo won the Cutina Award as the NCAA's top water polo player. He became the first Bears player to win the award in back-to-back seasons. Pampanacallo, who could play for Greece in the Olympics this summer, had two goals in the NCAA title game against UCLA. Did you know, in water polo, the only player who can legally touch the bottom of the pool is the goalie? Charlie Woods, Benjamin Buccaneers, golfer. He was born August 5th, 2001. High school, Benjamin School, hometown, Jupiter, Florida. The son of Tiger Woods, Charlie helped the Benjamin School to the first Florida Class 1A state championship, carding rounds of 76 and 74 for a two-round total of 154. In December, Charlie competed alongside his father at the PNC championship where they finished fifth. He also showed his dad's power, driving on shot 321 yards and over the green. Did you know Tiger Woods never won a high school state title because California only had regional championships? And now it's time for baseball. American League East, 2024 Major League Baseball. Number one, Baltimore Orioles. If you read Skip Shoremore's hot take, you'll know that Baltimore is about to get a new ownership group, and they don't seem shy about shelling out money. Bringing in starter Corbin Burns is a huge move, but the Orioles can't count on big bucks to bail them out of trouble. Fortunately, Baltimore is a young, hungry team, led by the reigning Rookie of the Year, infielder Gunnar Henderson. As long as these kids remember what allowed them to win 100 in games last year before a disappointing American League Division Series exit, 2 years removed from a 110-loss campaign, they will be a very tough team to topple. Number two, Tampa Bay Rays. If the expression, the more something changes, the more it stays the same, applies to one major league team, it's the Rays. Due to limited resources, Tampa's front office is constantly tinkering with the roster, such as picking up Yandy Diaz, who went on to become the 2023 American League batting champ from Cleveland in a trade no one paid attention to at the time. This offseason, the Rays sent ace Tyler Glasnow to the Dodgers in a deal that returned promising starter Ryan Peplott. Many teams don't like to shake things up, but Tampa has shown that continuity doesn't matter much. Number three, New York Yankees. In the late 1990s and early 2000s, the Yankees won world championships with brute force, picking up seemingly every big-name player on the market, then got this is fiscally impossible to sustain, and they started building more conventional teams, but not winning. Well, things could be changing. In December 2022, they re-signed Aaron Judge to a massive extension. And this offseason, they traded for Juan Soto, giving them an unmatched 1-2 punch. If ace Gerrit Cole gets any help in the pitching core, New York just might be able to follow the old formula to get back to the playoffs after an 82-win season. Number four, Toronto Blue Jays. The Blue Jays found themselves as a surprise players in the Shohei Ohtani sweepstakes over the winter. But since Ohtani chose the Dodgers, the Blue Jays' biggest move turned out to be re-signing outfielder Kevin Kiermaier. Unless it turns out Kiermaier can pitch, Toronto is going to be facing a decline, and time is of the essence to get things sorted out. The club's young core are anchored by Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and Bo Bichette is fast approaching free agency, meaning the team's window in a very tough division is closing fast. Number five, Boston Red Sox. Since winning the World Series in 2018, the Red Sox have missed the playoffs in four of five seasons. Last year's 78 and 84 mark was largely attributable to pitching staff. No starter had an ERA under 4.00. While Braylon Bello and Cooter Crawford showed promise, the team needs a number one starter. The Sox signed free agent Lucas Giolito. He was an all-star in 2019. He also had a 4.88 ERA last year with three teams. If Boston has any hope of reversing its slide, it needs a top-of-the-rotation arm to match up with the other aces in the division. And Giolito likely has to be that arm. American League Central, number one, Minnesota Twins. Last year, the American League Central featured two teams that lost more than 100 games and two others that finished at least eight games under 500. Someone has to win the division, and unless their home state miraculously shifts to a coast, sending them to a new division, it will probably be the Twins. Minnesota made the playoffs last year thanks in part to a solid pitching staff, one that lost two of its top starters in free agency this winter. The Twins tied for the American League lead in homers, and they will slug even more if Byron Buxton, 17 homers in 85 games, can stay healthy. In this division, that should be enough for a postseason return. Number two, Cleveland Guardians. Last year, Cleveland's outfielders hit 18 home runs, a total equaled or eclipsed by 123 individual players. The Poplar Guardians hit for a decent average, possess a lot of team speed, and play very good defense, epitomized by left fielder Stephen Kwan. So if baseball were to return to the dead ball era, Cleveland would be a real threat. Alas, flannel uniforms. Limp baseballs and oversized bats aren't making a return, so the Guardians will have to hope that they can win with a solid pitching and offense that will have to rely on singles and stolen bases. Number three, Detroit Tigers. Teams commonly try to lock up their young talent in long-term deals. The players get a guaranteed paycheck, while the team doesn't have to worry about his salary skyrocketing in arbitration. That's why Detroit locked up 22-year-old second baseman Colt Keith for 6 years, even though he hasn't spent a day in the majors. It's a good move if he contributes at all. Keith could bat first in a lineup that also includes 24-year-old slugger Spencer Torkelson and several other kids who give the Tigers hope for the future and an outside shot at competing this year. Number four, Kansas City Royals. Kansas City is not known as a team that throws money around, but that changed when the Royals gave shortstop Bobby Witt Jr. a mega deal worth $288.7 million over 11 years. They're paying the 23-year-old to be a superstar, and if Witt proved to be worth the money, Kansas City could become an intriguing team in a weak division. Sure, the Royals lost 106 games last year, but they thought it brought in loads of new faces, including starting pitchers Seth Lugo and Michael Wacha. Immediately upgrading a staff that had the third worst ERA, 5.17, in the majors. Number five, Chicago White Sox. The White Sox made the playoffs in 2021 under manager Tony La Russa, who was 76 years old. Chicago has been in a state of decline since, bottoming out with 101 losses last season under first-year skipper Pedro Grifol. La Russa's departure in 2022 marked a pivot away from the team's embrace of old-school baseball. But any rebuilding process takes time, and the best the Sox can do now is to build around their young talent, center fielder Lewis Robert Jr. Hit 30 home runs as a 25-year-old in 23. He could carry the team forward, just don't expect immediate results. American League West. Number one, Texas Rangers. The World Series champs were a feel-good story last year, as opposed to, say, the Mets, who were a study in dysfunction. Ace Max Scherzer witnessed both joining the Rangers at the trade deadline before New York, as long as Scherzer doesn't think he's back in the Big Apple and bring the Mets bad vibes to the Lone Star State, the Rangers should be tough to topple. Even though Scherzer will miss the beginning of the season with a back injury, Texas can count on a full season from late-season call-up Evan Carter, who joined the American League's most imposing lineup. Pitching is the issue, but the team added a few veteran bullpen arms. Number two, Houston Astros. Houston's biggest offseason move was to give a massive contract to free agent reliever Josh Hader. The $95 million deal is the largest the team has handed out under current ownership. That can't make Ryan Pressly very happy. He was very effective as Houston's closer last year in anchoring one of the league's best bullpens. As long as Pressly and Holder can coexist, that unit will be truly special. But the Astros didn't do much else to improve, and with several impending free agents, including Jose Altuve, it's hard not to think Houston's elite days could be numbered. Number three, Seattle Mariners. In one of the stranger offseason comments, Seattle general manager Jerry DePoto said his goal was to build a team that could win 88 games a year. It did not go over well with the fans, and he tried to walk it back. Still, that's pretty much what he's done. Set the Mariners up to be pretty good, with a great pitching staff and an iffy offense built around superstar Julio Rodriguez, who hit 32 homers last year as a 22-year-old. If 54% is good enough, then DePoto's team will be a postseason threat. Alas, that was Seattle's winning percentage last year, and in October, the Mariners were on the outside looking in. Number four, Los Angeles Angels. Last season, the Angels went all in at the trade deadline, opting not to trade Shohei Ohtani and even acquiring a few new players for a playoff push. It backfired remarkably. Los Angeles went into a massive slump and ended up releasing several players late in the season when it was clear the playoffs were not going to happen for them. Ohtani subsequently signed with the Dodgers. So, unless it was all a bad dream, L.A. is back in a familiar place, trying to figure out how to ride Mike Trout to the postseason. It hasn't worked in the past and likely won't work now. Number five, Oakland Athletics. This is what we know about the A's. They'll play in Oakland this year. They plan to move to Las Vegas in 2028. The 3 years in between, who knows? Last season, the lame duck A's drew barely 10,000 fans per game, giving them few resources to build a team. Fans can only hope that the team's ownership strikes it rich in Las Vegas. Otherwise, it's going to be another year of trying to compete with a bunch of guys making the league minimum, such as promising second baseman Zach Geloff. The future looks bleak in Oakland, and wherever the team plays next year. Now let's go to the NFL. Hold off on baseball for a while till next week. First downs. Jared Goff goes to the Rams 2016. If hockey team is really bad two seasons in a row, they can draft two centers. Think Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl. But an NFL team only needs one franchise QB. The Titans drafted Marcus Mariota second overall in 2015, so they dealt the first pick in 2016 along with their fourth and sixth round picks to the Rams for two firsts, two seconds, and two thirds. With one of the Rams' second round pick, the Titans took Derrick Henry, near right, who set a franchise record with 90 touchdowns. The Rams used the first pick on Cal quarterback Jared Goff, whom they later packaged with more first-rounders to acquire Matthew Stafford. The Panthers gave up their 2024 first-round pick for Bryce Young. Then they were the worst team in football. Fret not, Carolina fans. Many other teams have paid a hefty price for the top pick. Here we go. Michael Vick ends up in Atlanta, 2001. The San Diego Chargers were fine with the idea of drafting Virginia Tech quarterback Michael Vick with the first pick in 2001. They were less fine with giving him an eight-figure signing bonus. They had paid quarterback Ryan Leaf $11.25 million upon drafting him second overall in 1998. Leaf hadn't worked out, and the Chargers were nervous about shelling out for another top passer prospect. Rumors swirled that they might take TCU's LaDainian Tomlinson near right instead. Ultimately, they got to have their cake and eat it too. Trading down to number five, where they still got LaDainian Tomlinson. In the second round, they drafted Drew Brees, the best quarterback in the draft. Kai Jana Carter is picked by the Bengals, 1995. To modern eyes, this trade will seem nonsensical. The Bengals traded up to the number one pick to draft a running back, Kajana Carter. In return, the Panthers received the 5th and 36th picks, which they used on a quarterback, Kerry Collins, on the right, and a defensive end, Sean King. These days, quarterbacks and edge rushers go first, and winning running backs have to wait. It was, however, a run-heavy league. And Carter was the reigning Rose Bowl MVP. Unfortunately, an ACL injury derailed his career before it started. Collins didn't last long with Carolina, but he ended up starting 180 games over 17 seasons. Earl Campbell stays in Texas, 1978. If running backs were important in the 90s when Cincinnati traded up, they were really important in the 70s. The Houston Oilers traded their young tight end, Jimmy Giles, plus first, second, third, fifth round picks for the right to draft Texas running back Earl Campbell. With Houston's pick 17, Tampa Bay took quarterback Doug Williams, who would eventually win MVP honors in Super Bowl 22 with Washington. Campbell's Oilers career was brief but dominant, as he rushed for 5,081 yards and 45 touchdowns in his first three seasons. He won Offensive Player of the Year in all 3 years and MVP once. Jeff George goes first, then is traded for two firsts, 1994. A typical deal involves a few first-round picks plus selections in other rounds going for the number one selection. But in 1994, the Falcons traded the 7th and 83rd picks, plus their first in 96 for the top pick from 1990. The Colts had drafted local quarterback Jeff George, on the right, there 4 years prior and given him the biggest rookie contract ever. George didn't work out in Indy, but he flashed enough promise to command that large bounty. The Colts flipped the 7th pick to the 49ers, who took Hall of Famer defensive lineman Bryant Young, below left. The 96th pick became Hall of Fame wide receiver Marvin Harrison, below on the right. 2024 mock draft. Number one, the Chicago Bears have the first and ninth picks thanks to the last year's trade. Who will they take number one? Number one, Chicago Bears, Caleb Williams. The top quarterbacks in this year's class are USC's Caleb Williams and North Carolina's Drake May. Last year, it seemed like C.J. Stroud had a shot to go to the Panthers before Bryce Young got the honor. This time, we think Williams stays the number one choice. Number two, Washington Commanders, wide receiver Marvin Harrison Jr. See that guy in the blue and white catching a ball just above these words? His son is draft eligible and every bit as good as his dad. Too often teams take the quarterback without the weapons to help them succeed. Washington gets the best player available in this scenario. New England Patriots quarterback Drake May. Mac Jones hasn't worked out for New England and reportedly didn't get along with fellow quarterback Bailey Zapp last season. So bring someone new in. Pats fans would probably be ecstatic if May goes at number three. He has a big arm and can score points with his legs when needed. Number four, Arizona Cardinals. Wide receiver Rome Andunze. If there's a run on quarterbacks early in the draft, the Cardinals could end up with Harrison, but Andunze is no mere consolation prize. Known for his size and route-running ability, he would instantly become a much-needed go-to receiver for Kyler Murray. Number five, Los Angeles Chargers. Offensive tackle Joe Ault. Jim Harbaugh liked to run the ball at Michigan, and you need big guys up front to do that. The Chargers averaged under 100 yards rushing per game last season. The tall Mr. Ault, 6'8", is not just easy to get around, and he's just as much of an asset in the passing game. And number six, New York Giants offensive tackle Olumaye Fashanu. The Giants allowed their quarterback to be sacked 85 times last season. The two next worst teams were tied at 65 sacks allowed. Some evaluators have Penn State's Fashanu ahead of Ault. That's why we're projecting six offensive players in a row in 2024. Ron Airey lands in Minnesota, 1968. The AFL and NFL used to be two leagues with two separate drafts where they would pick from the same pool of players. As a condition of the two drafts finally merging, the New York Giants negotiated to receive the top selection in either 1967 or 68 drafts, regardless of their record in those seasons. Then they traded this special pick to the Minnesota Vikings for veteran quarterback Fran Tarkington. The Vikings exercised the option to take offensive tackle Ron Yeary first in 1968. Tarkington made four Pro Bowls with the Giants before being traded again. Yeary was a six-time All-Pro and eventual Hall of Famer for the Vikings. Trending. Kyle Hamilton, Baltimore Ravens safety. Thanks to a mom who pushed him to be curious, this Renaissance man plays music, creates art, boasts a huge IQ, and dominates on the football field. When Kyle Hamilton qualified for Mensa, he didn't know that Mensa existed. That makes sense because he was in the third grade. If you don't know what Mensa is, it's an organization for people who do exceedingly well on intelligence tests. Hamilton got in by scoring 132 on an IQ test. His mother filled out the Mensa application for him and tried to explain the whole thing to him. Her son just shrugged, partly because he was so young and partly because that's the way he's always been. Fast forward about 15 years. Kyle Hamilton is still a genius, but unlike many of his fellow Mensa members, he's not yet a scientist or a business executive or a doctor. He plays safety for the Baltimore Ravens, and he's racking up accolades. Voted the Ravens' good guy by local journalists. Named the youngest defensive starter for the Pro Bowl at 22. Named first-team All-Pro as selected by his peers. Hamilton might be the most versatile player in a league in which that specific trait has never been more valued. He covers large swaths deep downfield. He double teams top targets. He blitzes quarterbacks and stuffs running backs and often slides over to play cornerback. Hamilton can also golf, scoring around 80 with minimal practice, play the trombone, drain three-pointers on basketball courts, score on Victor Wembanyama, for so he claims, crush home runs, write, sing, solve, adapt, plan, improvise, destroy video game opponents, and still find time to binge Netflix. Hamilton, in other words, can do anything. In fact, he believes that doing many things makes him better at all the things. They complement each other, he says. They give me a better grasp of the whole defense, allowing me to see where everybody's going to be and how I can fit off that. His mother, Jackie, watches all the things unspool, and she can see what seems obvious, that a child of varied interests influences activities and skills prepared him to become the perfect skeleton key for one of the NFL's top defenses. Jackie laughs. It's funny because it's true. Trust me, she says. That was not the plan. It was instead the byproduct of a parenting strategy that focused on activity. Hamilton devoured the book series Diaries of a Wimpy Kid. One featured a blank page to scribble down life goals. He wrote, play in the NFL and play in the NBA. Okay, but how? Jackie gave her boys extra homework in the form of workbooks, writing, science, math, and many others. She took them to museums, then placed them through art projects that mimicked what inspired them inside. When they wanted to visit the zoo, she ferried them back as well, but only in exchange for learning about the animals. And every morning, whether school was in or session or not, she gave her children one word from the dictionary, which they had to learn, spell, and apply. Hamilton won prizes for his school artwork while acing his classes and playing the sports year-round. He outran the wind, leaped toward the heavens, and accumulated a basement's worth of trophies. He earned gifted programs for high achievers. The breadth of his interests and skills led him to the prestigious Marist School and then on to Notre Dame. Jackie knew her son excelled at sports. She wanted him to excel at anything, a task he seemed to have taken literally. She kept on giving him those workbooks. She's also keenly aware that her son, the Mensa member, hasn't finished his marketing degree at Notre Dame. She jokingly referred to him as a college dropout and his NFL career as his seasonal job. He left school. We've run out of time for today's episode of Sports Illustrated for Kids. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed. I'm John Ivey, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.